Support for the Memory Palace comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/memory. That's odoo.com/memory.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. Little Rose, when she was 8 years old, on the day she went to prison with her mother, looked the warden in the eye and warned him, "You have one of the hardest little rebels here you ever saw." That is how her mother told the story. The way she tells it in her memoir, My Imprisonment and the First Year of Abolitionist Rule at Washington, published in 1863. She admonished the little girl after that, told her she had to be careful about what she said. But there is no small bit of pride that infuses her description of her youngest child, the hardest little rebel, for Rose Greenhow's daughter had learned well. The older Rose herself was a daughter of the South, if not technically. Her home state of Maryland never seceded from the Union, to her abiding chagrin. But her father owned 560 acres just north of Washington, and owned 15 human beings who planted it. And after his death, when Rose was just a little girl, his widow had to sell the farm and the people and move to D.C. And so Rose grew up in what would be, for a time, the capital of the North, where she learned to be a Southern lady and became a fixture on the social scene, and the wife of a handsome doctor from Virginia, whose job in the State Department brought her into the circles of diplomats and bluebloods, and under the ideological spell of South Carolina Senator and firebrand John C. Calhoun. Rose was widowed herself at 40, left with 4 daughters. 2 of them were married, a third who died of typhoid not long after, at 14, and a baby who had her name. She and Little Rose lived in a 3-story mansion just across Lafayette Park from the White House. And that house on 16th Street was a hub of elite social life during the Buchanan administration, in a Washington slipping toward war. There were parties and teas and pop-bys by dignitaries and legislators and military men. Little Rose playing in the garden, sitting on the staircase watching the grown-ups through the bars of the banister. And rumors always circled around the charming and lovely widow Greenhow, about flirtations and more with a number of these dignitaries. And when Lincoln was sworn in and South Carolina seceded, her city changed. Families chose sides. The drawbridges across the Potomac, suddenly the thin border between two nations, were raised every night at sundown. Friends packed up their belongings and headed southward at dawn. They told her she should do the same. It wasn't safe for her there. But she had Little Rose to take care of, and she had work to do. She turned her home into a kind of clubhouse for secessionists, where they could share news and rumors and plot ways to resist Lincoln and the abolitionists. And one evening in the spring of 1861, a friend, a quartermaster in the Union Army, came to her. He said he was going to defect. He had a posting waiting for him with the Confederate Army massing in Manassas, Virginia, and he knew she knew everyone. He knew the rumors of her ongoing affair with a Massachusetts senator, with a seat on the Committee for Military Affairs. He knew she could get him to tell her things he shouldn't, and he taught her a cipher, a code she could use to tell those things in secret to the Confederate Army. During the first summer of the Civil War, Little Rose's mother ran a spy ring out of the house on 16th Street with a good climbing tree in the backyard. Rose Greenhow had informants and conspirators in and out day and night. She sent coded messages on troop movements, gunnery positions at forts, inventories of supplies and arms. Sent them out hidden in the hollowed-out boot heels of couriers, in the braids of a debutante posing as a humble farm girl. She got word of the timing of the first Union invasion of Virginia to the generals at Manassas, and when those generals won what would come to be known as First Bull Run. Rose and Little Rose celebrated their victory, and Mama's role in it. The neighbors noticed all of this, of course. People coming in and out night and day. And so they weren't at all surprised when they saw the little girl next door up in her climbing tree, in her dress and her ringlets, raising the alarm. Mother has been arrested. Rose Greenhouse spent the first autumn of the Civil War under house arrest. Little Rose could have gone to stay with relatives, but her mother wouldn't allow it. In part, it seems because she had lost another daughter to typhoid not long before. And in part because she didn't trust anyone else to raise her right, with the right values and the right politics. And she was so proud of her little girl, and of her behavior during the 5 months when little Rose would spend her days all alone in a small maid's room, a room that her mother wasn't allowed to enter because the detectives were afraid she'd use its windows with slatted blinds to signal to conspirators outside. But that may not have stopped her from using her daughter as a conduit for coded missives, passed on to visitors she herself wasn't allowed to see. She may too have had little Rose's help in weaving tapestries, made to transmit secret messages with each choice of color. Little Rose was a good daughter, in her mother's eyes. During the 8 months the two of them spent at the old Capitol Prison, on the spot where the Supreme Court stands now, from that first day when she sassed the warden, declared herself the hardest rebel he ever did see, through every sleepless night, suffering the real indignities of foul food and bugs and rats, and phony outrages of being housed in a building that had a wing for black prisoners, of hearing the disgusting laughter of some of those prisoners' children as they played in the yard. As for her own child, Rose felt nothing but pride in her toughness in the face of deprivation and of cold nights in a bed of hard-packed straw, and in her fierce defiance that had her taunting Yankee children, also there with their parents, telling them their side's defeat was imminent, that Jeff Davis was coming for them. In time, it was the Greenhouse who would go to Jeff Davis. They left prison at the end of the spring of 1862 and were exiled to the Confederate States on condition that Rose Greenhow wouldn't return north until after the war. They steamed south along the coast and up the James River, past shattered warships half submerged, past towns burnt and abandoned, and were greeted like conquering heroes. And there below the Mason-Dixon, sleeping again in soft beds, being toasted by the old families of this new country as the platonic ideal of Confederate womanhood, beautiful, savvy, sophisticated, and dedicated to the Southern ways of gentility and white supremacy. Rose Greenhow felt like she was finally at home. But she didn't hesitate when President Davis himself asked her to leave for Europe as an emissary of the Confederate States of America. And soon she and Little Rose were on a ship, slipping past the Union blockade in the dead of night. For 2 years, they traveled through England and France. Rose met with Queen Victoria, published her memoir, rallied old world aristocrats to the Confederate cause. And she left Little Rose, then 10 years old, at a convent on the left bank in Paris, so she would be safe as she awaited the coming victory and awaited her mother's return. Little Rose's mother never came back for her. Never showed up at the convent in France some years later, marveling, beaming through happy tears at how she'd grown. Rose Greenhow never made it back home to the Confederate States of America. The boat she was on ran aground off the coast of North Carolina after being pursued by a Union ship. She grabbed the secret papers she was bringing back from England and $2,000 worth of gold, and climbed into a lifeboat, which capsized in rough water. And the gold dragged her down to the bottom and she drowned. There is a famous photo of mother and daughter. Rose sits on a bench in the crumbling yard of the old Capitol Prison. She has a black, elaborate dress with heavy pleating, sleeves made of some sort of translucent material that end in a ruffled cuff. The hem drags in the dirt. She wears black leather gloves. Her hair is back, tight and severe with a crisp center part, and some sort of black lace veil falling down her shoulders. She has her arm around her daughter, who stands in a hoop skirt that lands mid-calf over white stockings. They lean into each other. They don't smile, but there is something bright and defiant in their eyes. That kind of says, that seems at least, to say it all. There are many books written about Rose Greenhow. There are standalone biographies. There's a whole cottage industry of histories of spying in the Civil War. She's always got a chapter. There is her own memoir of her imprisonment. She kept journals that detail her experiences and her emotional state during those experiences, at least what she wants the reader to know about them. The National Archive has many of her letters. And there are enough examples of her cipher online that the curious would-be cryptologist can crack the code pretty easily. It was fairly simple. A system of curves and slashes and symbols that were baffling if you only had a single message. But if you had a few different messages, if you had enough information, you could cross-reference them. And then you could understand everything. There aren't any books written about Little Rose. She's in her mother's memoir and journals. She's a bit player in most of the books about her mother. A scene stealer, but still. You see her in that prison yard picture. The one that seems to say it all. But after that photograph, after the 8 months of her life spent in that prison, she starts to disappear from her mother's story. One book has her in England, seeing a ship in the harbor flying the Stars and Bars, and lighting up, saying, "There is our flag, Mama," to her mother's delight. Another might tell you about how she was left at the convent, always a plot point in her mother's story. But nothing tells us about how she felt about being left at that convent. There is little that tells us about how she felt about anything. One book mentions a letter she wrote near the turn of the 20th century, written, I believe, in response to a historian looking for details about her mother's story. She says she remembers crying herself to sleep every night while at the old Capitol prison. And that's the extent of her own assessment of her inner life. And we are left trying to define meaning from fragments, from the few scraps of biography we have about her life beyond mere months, a few seasons when she was at her mother's side. There is the letter from the nun at the convent that says Little Rose was inconsolable after learning of Rose's death, and says that sometime later, Little Rose asked to be baptized so she could better pray for her mother. A genealogy tells us that she returned to the States, still united, after the war. And she was married at 18 to a West Point graduate from a fine family from Rhode Island. Yankees through and through. But nothing tells us about what that meant to her, or about whether she wondered, whether she worried about what her mother might have felt about it. Did thoughts of her mother haunt her? Was hers a voice that came to her, that kept her up at night when her marriage fell apart? And why did her marriage fall apart? There's another fragment of her story that suggests that the divorce left her broke, and that led her to the theater, where she, a woman in her 40s or 50s, the timing is unclear, would take to the stage as Little Rose, the girl from the story of Rose Greenhow, famous Confederate spy, and return night after night to those 8 months she spent with her mother in prison. Before a bag of gold earned from her mother's own telling of that same story dragged her to the ocean floor. One book tells us that she found this demoralizing, and she stopped performing and returned to France, and lived out the rest of her life in religious devotion. But why was it demoralizing? Did she think the theater was beneath her? As a religious woman, or as the ex-wife of an important military man, or as Little Rose, daughter of Rose Greenhow, hero of the lost cause? Was it merely too unnerving to step on stage as the living after picture, to that famous photograph in the prison yard, to stand up there at middle age as little Rose? Did she even believe in the story anymore? She had lived for decades in the North. She had been a Yankee's wife. She had come of age in post-war America. She had seen the meaning of that war change and change again. She was once the hardest little rebel. She was once a good Southern daughter. She spent 8 months of her life, at 8 years old, with her mother in a prison cell, believing in her mother, and the cause that her mother believed in enough to put them there. What did she think of that cause at 18? Or 35? Or 57? In 1910, half a century after her mother died, and after she went out into the world, as we all do, to find out whether our parents had been right about the world. We don't have enough messages to break the code. The Memory Palace is produced by me, Nate DeMeo, with engineering assistance from Elizabeth Aubert. Its ad music is composed by J.D. Sampson. We get ad-serving technology from AdZerk and support from the Knight Foundation and listeners like you. This show is part of Radiotopia, a network from PRX, which is making me particularly proud these days as we are about to launch a new show called Ear Hustle that is going to tell stories from within San Quentin Prison, told by the prisoners themselves. And I am genuinely super excited about this. And in a second, I'm going to play a little preview, and I think you'll be excited about the whole thing too. And after that, I want you to do two things. First, you're going to go to iTunes or Google Play or wherever you listen to podcasts and go subscribe to Ear Hustle. And second, I want you to head over to radiotopia.fm. All of the shows from Radiotopia this month have been doing stories unified by a theme in honor of the Ear Hustle launch. The theme is doing time, and you just heard my contribution, so now you can go to radiotopia.fm and collect them all and hear everyone else's. But first, let's hear Ear Hustle.
The following podcast contains language that may not be appropriate for all listeners.
I did not realize that I could be potentially facing life in prison.
Now I'm going to drag you through four corners of this cell.
It's like that. It's like, I don't want to be in prison, but I want to know what it's like to be in prison.
You really think people want to know what it's like in prison?
Hell yeah, of course.
You got all these TV shows, new programs, like Prison Break.
Orange is the New Black, Locked Up. You won't let me.
And you know all the shows.
But they all bullshit, though.
Why? Why are they bullshit?
Is it because ain't none of them serving time.
They ain't never did no real time.
They acting.
Yeah, and in prison ain't really like that. Nah, man, we just living life.
Like everybody else. I'm Earlonne Woods.
Earlonne is serving a 31-year-to-life sentence for attempted second-degree robbery, and he's the co-host and co-producer of Ear Hustle.
And that is Nigel Poor. She's a visual artist who works with incarcerated men here at San Quentin, and she's the co-producer and co-host of Ear Hustle. See, she brings a softer touch to the show.
Thanks, Antoine.
Welcome.
That's Antoine Williams. He's serving a 15-year sentence for armed robbery with a gun enhancement. And he's the sound designer for Ear Hustle.
I believed I was going to die in prison.
She was happy to be with me.
We all work together inside of the media lab in San Quentin Prison, where we produce Ear Hustle.
And it's all done inside the prison. I mean, the interviewing, editing, sound design by your boy.
And that's really cool, but it also is super challenging because we have limited hours we can work, we've got no internet access, and we can't even freaking talk to each other on the phone.
What?
And on top of all that, prison is never a quiet place.
Hold up.
Sorry.
Okay.
And that's great, the phone's ringing. Hey, E, tell everyone what Ear Hustling means.
It means being nosy and eavesdropping.
And learning more about what actually happens inside of prison.
You'll be hearing directly from the guys that's doing the time.
See, we're going to be telling stories, all kind of stories that range from starting a family.
Having pets.
Misguided loyalty.
Fashion.
Ooh, cooking.
Isolation.
Sibling rivalry.
Mommy-daddy time.
And we got a lot of ground to cover over our first season.
We decided to kick off this season with a story that everybody can relate to. Finding somebody to live with.
In prison terms, that means finding a cellmate.
Can we hear just a little bit of it?
Nope.
Yep. Nope.
Wait, oh, yeah. Okay, wait.
Just a little bit.
Hold All on. Right. Hold on, hold on.
Only because you said please.
When we were cellies, I didn't smoke. He was smoking cigarettes and he just lit up right there on the bunk.
And he was like, man, you're trying to kill me. You're killing me with this. You're going to kill me with cancer. Man, shut the fuck up with that shit, man. God. It's like, man, we are in prison for life. You know, I have 67 years to life. Man, I am smoking this cigarette.
So that's episode one of Ear Hustle. Coming soon from Radiotopia from PRX. Before we go, huge props to a crucial partner in all of this, and that's Lieutenant Sam Robinson, the San Quentin Public Information Officer. Without his guidance and support, none of this would be happening.
He also has to listen to all of our stories and okay them before they go out, even this promo. So what about it, Lieutenant? Are we cool?
This is Lieutenant Sam Robinson, the Public Information Officer at San Quentin State Prison, and I approve this story.
And please visit our website, earhustlesq.com. You can subscribe to the podcast, sign up for our newsletter, and find out how to send us a question by postcard that we might answer on a future episode.
That's earhustlesq.com.
So kick back, relax, because we're about to take you inside.
They can lock the body up, but they can't lock the mind up.
Radiotopia.